Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What has happened to American conservatism? After decades of dominance, my guest today worries many right-leaning leaders in contemporary American politics are in fact less devoted to preserving the traditions of civil society than to trying to retake ideological ground no longer disputed by the broader society. And he's concerned that a less than purely conservative influence in U.S. politics ultimately is detrimental to healthy and productive discourse across the political spectrum. Sam Tannenhaus is editor of both the New York Times Book Review and Week in Review. His new book is called The Death of Conservatism. Sam, welcome to Think.
Hey, Chris. Great to be with you.
One fascinating irony in what you're exploring here is that while you are writing about the death of conservatism, you also point out that the country has entered its most conservative phase since the Eisenhower administration. Can you explain that?
Well, sure. If we look around, those of us with some memories of how the culture was comporting itself 20 or 30 years ago, it's kind of hard to believe that homosexuals in America actually want to enter the institution of marriage and raise children, that kids being groomed on our supposedly left-wing college campuses are either heading off to the financial sector or looking for ways to combine a kind of countercultural view of the marketplace through the internet with more old-fashioned ideas of free commerce, which itself narrows a divide between, you know, the business elite on the one hand and the intellectual elite on the other. In other words, all these divisions that were supposed to be setting us at one another's throats actually seem to have gone away, and everyone's aware of it except for some people on the right. And it seemed to me that the time for some conservatives should come where they say, you know what, we won some of these wars, that Americans are kind of moving toward the center or moving toward an old-fashioned idea of how to preserve the institutions and government in our society, and this should be welcomed. Instead, we're seeing a replay of these very, as you said, these outmoded culture wars.
So how does what you call movement conservatism differ from what you define as classical conservatism?
Well, what we forget is that modern conservatism, which really dates back now two centuries or more to the great writings of the Scottish philosopher and member of Parliament, Edmund Burke, was grounded in the anxieties created by revolution, particularly in his case, the French Revolution. And Burke, who observed it from afar but very closely, saw that ideologues of a kind, movement radicals, we might call them, were leading an august nation that did have many defects in its political and social structure, a very rigid class system, very little opportunity for the middle class to participate in politics. The poorer orders were kept lower than they ought to be in a rich modern nation. All these terrible things were going on, but instead of working to ameliorate conditions, to make things a little better, the leaders of the French Revolution wanted to tear everything down. And Burke said, what we need is a politics that recognizes the value of civil society, that instead of just ripping the fabric apart, why don't we look for ways to conserve and correct? And that this is the course conservatism should take. This is actually the meaning of conservatism. Well, then we flash forward to our own era, particularly during the Cold War. And what we saw was a sequence of presidents. I begin it with Eisenhower, all the way through Bill Clinton, who, in effect, followed this prescription. Eisenhower, who was the first Republican president the country had had in two full decades, we sometimes forget, in the 1930s and 1940s, the only presidents American had were Democrats. Franklin Roosevelt for four terms, Harry Truman for a fifth. Eisenhower then came into office, looked at what had preceded him. His own ideological wing in the Republican Party expected, indeed demanded, that he roll back the New Deal, that he undo all these reforms that Roosevelt and Truman had instated. Instead, Eisenhower looked at it and said, no, it works. This is what people have come to expect. They expect a safety net. The New Deal is part of the fabric of their lives. To undo it in a dramatic way would be radical and not conservative. Then we flash forward 40 years to 1992. Bill Clinton is elected following three successive Republican presidents, the Reagan Revolution, as we call it. Clinton came into office as a new style Democrat who actually accepted many of the changes instituted by the Republicans during their noontime period. And he decided they also kind of worked. The free market economy was prosperous. It was generating jobs. We had found a way to work through to the end of the Cold War. So instead of shifting the country to the left, he kind of kept it in the middle. He steered down the center. This is the kind of conservatism that Burke had in mind all those years ago. And what's happened now is that type of conservative, someone who believed not necessarily in government, but in governance, in the authority our elected officials have to guide us toward a sensible path by listening to the will of the voters, that seems to have disappeared. And we've seen an attempt really to discredit American politics and government coming from so-called conservatives who sound like radicals.
It's your sense that Burke might not even recognize the brand of conservatism being practiced today in this country.
I think he would have a hard time. Now, there are certain aspects of it that would make sense to him. You know, Burke wrote in a period when there was a Church of England, and he would have understood the emphasis on religion. But he also believed in the national obligation of political parties. I quote what to me in my book is a remarkable assertion by the late and quite brilliant Irving Kristol, the neoconservative philosopher and thinker and writer and journalist who died just this past week. And Kristol, who had been a kind of Burkean conservative in my formulation, by the 1990s was saying something very different. He said, conservatism in America is a movement. It has no obligation to any political party. The party doesn't do what the movement wants, then movement conservatives will walk away. Now, in my view, that is actually a defiance of the obligation citizens have to respect the institutional authority of the party. So I think of whatever party they belong to, I think Burke would really have trouble with that. I think also he would be dismayed by the spectacle of protesters in Washington who, remember, did not only attack and really try to dishonor our president, but also denounced politicians in both parties. Democrats, Republicans, we don't care, we don't want them, we want the bums out. That's not the way a civil society is supposed to function. We're actually supposed to show some respect and sympathy and belief in the people we elect to office. It doesn't mean we agree with them, doesn't mean we don't replace them, but at least we honor what they do as part of the larger fabric of our society. And, of course, the now notorious remark by Joseph Wilson on the floor of Congress is just another example of that, a kind of repudiation of the very idea that America's political institutions are valuable. That is what the radicals on the left said back in the late 1960s. When they attacked our government, marched in the streets, and all the rest. It was actually that movement by them that enabled responsible conservatives to come to power. So why on earth would conservatives today seem to be following that same destructive course? It's a mystery to me.
Let's talk for a minute about the response to that outburst during the president's address to Congress, and who's really keeping it alive at this point? Because you have the president saying, "I accept the apology; it was inappropriate, and I'm moving on." And then you have a lot of very powerful Democrats who say, "This it's not enough. We need to keep talking about this, and we really need to censure this person for having made those remarks."
I do agree with the president that it's foolish at this point. It was one of those moments whose own theatrical reality sort of contained itself. You know, the apology was fine. It was interesting, by the way, in his apology, Congressman Wilson said that he had been uncivil. He had not shown civility, which goes directly to the heart of this idea of classical conservatism, of the civil society. I think at this point, yes, it's become a political football. And it's good that you bring it up, because it's not as if conservatives are only to blame for the political quandary we're in. I think the president understands this, and he finds himself, in fact, sort of undermined by an ex-president, Jimmy Carter, who dragged race in a complicated way. On the other hand, these are long-standing issues and divisions within our culture. I think maybe the best guidepost to all of this is the great historian Richard Hofstadter, who figures in my book, when he described really two different kinds of conservatism, what he called a pseudo-conservatism, which is built on resentment and anger and grievance, versus a true conservatism, again, what I call classical conservatism. But what he saw more broadly, Hofstadter did, is that a lot of our politics is really about cultural antagonisms, what he called the symbolic aspect of our politics, the words we use, the names we call each other, that this often goes to the center of our identity. So it's not really surprising to me that these symbolic displays should dominate the very difficult policy decisions and solutions that the Democrats in particular are struggling to work out.
With due respect to William F. Buckley, you write that noisemakers and pyrotechnicians are effectively all that remains of this cherished conservative tradition in this country. What makes them at this point so much stronger, Sam, than their more measured peers?
I think it is, again, this notion of the theatricality of our politics. And, of course, it was Buckley who were quoting there, and he says the right has always had its share of pyrotechnicians and noisemakers. And I think because politics is so much a spectacle today, quite remarkably, Richard Hofstadter wrote in 1954, a passage I quote in this book, that American politics has become a form of endless continuous theater. It is displayed constantly, and the individual citizen uses it as the means to express his own psychological anxieties. And Hofstadter was reacting to the televised hearings that Joseph McCarthy participated in, the Army McCarthy hearings. Even then, it was clear that politics was changing. It was becoming less a conflict of economic interest or of class division than it was of cultural division and enmity. And so what happens is, when politics shifts in that way, the parties, the sort of technicians of our politics, are sidelined a little bit, and the showmen in our politics take over. The Glenn Becks, for instance, or the Rush Limbaughs, people who have a flair for dramatizing the cultural aspect, the theatrical aspect of politics, are now, for the first time in modern memory, actually setting the agenda for an entire party. I don't think we've seen that before.
Would you say that the institutions of modern media have been sort of unwitting helpmates in this, or have we fed it in ways, and speaking generally here, in ways that we're culpable for?
We're all complicit. Mm-hmm. We're all complicit. I'm complicit. I'm complicit when a book comes out with a provocative title like The Death of Conservatism. Yes, we all participate in it. I'm a journalist. I've written a lot, many articles, many essays. They're different in some ways in tone and approach from the big biographies I've written, either of Whitaker Chambers and now the one I'm working on, and William F. Buckley. There's a different kind of tonality. Now, I think I've written a very serious book. I've put in all the Death of Conservatism, all the writing and thinking that I've done over these 20 years. I've tried to distill it, and yet it offers itself as an object of provocation and controversy. And if we listen to radio and watch television and read the internet, there's more and more, absolutely, and no one is entirely free of it. And that's probably good. I mean, no one should be above the fray. We should recognize, though, where the fray is occurring, what field it's being played on.
Sam Tannenhouse is with us. The new book is The Death of Conservatism. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is editor of the New York Times Book Review and Week in Review, Sam Tannenhaus. His new book is called The Death of Conservatism. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Sam, you are adamant here that the conservative movement and the GOP are not one and the same, or at least should not be. How does that compare with what you're observing right now?
Well, I think we're seeing in the repudiation of the party the disdain that's shown by so many activists in the movement that the two are separate. They should be separate. You know, if you remember right after the election of 2008, when there was much consternation among conservatives, although they well knew that that President Obama was likely to be elected, there was a fair amount of recrimination against the Republican Party. They've ceased to be conservative. They become their own collection of interests tied to Washington. And some of that was true. I mean, in fact, that's what parties are supposed to do, is be aggregations of interest. That's why we have only two major parties, because so many different factions and systems of beliefs can actually be accommodated within them. I think the mistake was that the movement became so dominant that it really assumed the party should be an extension of it. And we forget there was a period when there was an entire contingent of Northern Republicans, for instance, who in many ways were more liberal than Southern Democrats. Those are the old alignments within the two parties that were more regional in some ways than ideological. And this was actually a strength within our system. So that, for instance, when Eisenhower was president, both the leaders in Senate and the House, Lyndon Johnson, the Senate Majority Leader, and Sam Rayburn in the House, both Texans, actually decided they would do something we've not heard of, that they would, quote, help the president govern, unquote. And the understanding then was that the parties were really flexible, malleable instruments for determining consensus. And what's been replaced, what's taken the place of consensus, I describe in the book, is orthodoxy, the idea that there's a set of beliefs, of principles, a litmus test or agenda that any good right-thinking conservative must adhere to. And in fact, this actually contradicts the very way our democracy works. So in a sense, there was bound to be a collision between the movement and the party. The surprise is that the movement at this point seems to be driving the conversation more than the party. The party has really sidelined itself. There were almost no Republicans involved in the economic stimulus. In fact, not a single House Republican voted for it. We're seeing again with this important health care debate that all the arguments are occurring within the Democratic Party. Now, there's historical precedent for this. In the book, I mentioned something called the solar system theory of American politics, that what we think of as a two-party system is really a rotating cycle of one-party dominance. So that in the Reagan era, for instance, it was Republicans who fought among themselves about the big issues of the day, whether it was abortion or the role of evangelicals in politics or how to conclude the Cold War. Today, the Republicans are now the so-called moon party in our solar system, and the Democrats are the sun. So the fight about the best health care policy will be between the president on the one hand, Max Baucus on another, Senator Wyden of Oregon on a third. It's the Democrats themselves who are actually going to legislate us into the future. And if Republicans refuse to participate in those serious debates, they could end up being a marginal party. For all the noise the conservatives make, the Republicans as an institution could be marginalized for a generation.
Sam Tannenhaus is my guest. His new book is called The Death of Conservatism. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Phil in Plano. Hello, Phil.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to know if you're just to comment on the basic contradiction in the conservative mantra that government is the problem, yet Ronald Reagan grew the government substantially. And then the subsequent amnesia that, you know, that the following Republicans continue.
Great point. And in fact, I do mention this in the book that, yes, under Ronald Reagan, the government grew enormously. Ronald Reagan, who in his early years as a political figure in the 1960s, when he was essentially a follower of Barry Goldwater, opposed Social Security, opposed Medicare, and said the graduated income tax came directly from Karl Marx. Now, once he ran for president in 1980, he promised the middle class he would protect Social Security and Medicare, neither would be touched. And then once in office, although he slightly reduced some of the programs by percentage points in outlays, eliminated almost none of them, and the government got bigger. Well, one reason is that the main government expenditure for the last 50 or 60 years has been the military. So, of course, government and society, the protection of our independence and freedom, and the obligations to participate in the world as a superpower and unipolar power now, require huge government. And so the notion that there can ever really be a small or minimized government is really a kind of illusion. As I say in the book, everybody wants big government. They just want government that's big for them, whether they want big defense spending, whether they want an improved or enlarged health care system, whether they think government should be a kind of federalized safety net for Wall Street, which we've seen. There's really almost no one who would be content living in the imagined world of a very small government. What Republicans have been very good at, conservative ideologues in particular, is saying, well, government is good when it does some things, but not others, which is a legitimate argument. There's an entire chapter in my book called Tangled Pathologies about how the Great Society programs under Lyndon Johnson grew so big, promised so much to so many people, that when in the late 1960s there actually was a failure to deliver the good life that people had come to expect from government, conservatives actually occupied the center and became the dominant force. And so I think there's actually a word of caution for the Democrats and Obama as we go ahead. There's a difference between a kind of New Deal liberalism that gives us a safety net and a great society liberalism, which actually promises to improve the quality of our lives. The distinction can be fine, but it can be a crucial one.
I want to go back for a minute, Sam, to this idea of the solar system theory of American politics. Given that a democracy would seem strongest when there is, in fact, a balance between different political positions and ideals as opposed to those which exist within one party or another, why do you think that they are so seldomly evenly matched at any one point in time?
Well, what we've seen, Chris, is that where they become matched is in the different branches of government. Eisenhower, for instance, was very effective at working with Democratic legislators. The two groups, so the executive and the legislative branch, found common ground. Bill Clinton, you'll remember, after he lost control of the House to Newt Gingrich in the Contract with America, actually found he could get a little more done with the Republicans than with the liberal wing in his own party. In fact, President Obama's problem right now is that his own party is divided, whereas the opposition party marches in lockstep. So that even though he has technical majorities, it's hard for him to combine them, to coerce them. So I think what happens is that the party in the outs, the moon party traveling its orbital path, actually collects some of the energies that most of us who are in the middle, the independents, feel. And they actually may become the better representatives or spokespeople for those independent views. And that's how they gain some strength. We are now so sharply divided between the two parties that the middle room that formed our politics has gone away. And that's why we don't see what we once had, which was a balance between the two in the legislative process and the prosecution of foreign policy and all the rest.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Ronnie in Fort Worth. Hi, Ronnie.
Hi. Hey, I just have a quick comment. I wanted to say that, me personally, I cannot wait for conservatism to die. And I say that because I'm really tired of the whole moral agenda, the conservative idea, the moral agenda of being shoved down my throat. I think that people in general are good at heart. I think that there's evil in all of us, but I do believe that for the most part there is good in everybody, and I think that good will overcome. And I don't mean to sound like I'm some kind of idealist, because I truly am not, but I just do believe that in the whole big scheme of things, that good will overcome. And I hear people, you know, you were talking about Rush Limbaugh and some of these other guys earlier. I think that their moral agenda is pushed so hard, and they're so mean-spirited, and if you disagree with what those guys have to say, then they chastise you something awful, and there's no room for open debate, open discussion, that's real discussion, where people can talk and give their ideas, and let's come to some kind of a consensus, or maybe not a consensus. I truly believe that we all can agree to disagree. We don't have to buy into each other's ideas, and we can live that way without throwing rocks at one another and having, you know, causing hate and discontent.
Ronnie, thanks so much for your call. Sam, I think a lot of people now define the conservative movement in that way, but there are plenty of conservatives who are not particularly interested in a moral agenda and putting that onto other people.
Well, the caller does make a good point. You know, it shows us where we seem to have traveled since the real heyday of conservatism in America, which happened intellectually, I think, among the writers and thinkers. And they're as much a part of my story as the political leaders in the 1960s and early 1970s, and politically in the 1980s. Ronald Reagan, whatever you thought of him, whether you agreed with him or not, whether you liked his economic policy, whether you liked his Cold War programs, wherever you stood there, at least he seemed to radiate a sense of optimism. And what we have now is a conservatism almost closer to what it was in the time of Herbert Hoover, who's also a figure in my book. Herbert Hoover denounced Franklin Roosevelt in precisely the same language that after the election the Republicans began already denouncing Barack Obama in. Hoover called Roosevelt alternately a socialist and a fascist, and accused him of leading us down the road to socialism and of taking our liberties and freedoms away from us. I wonder how many listeners remember that not long after the election, in about February or March, there was actually a movement afoot within the Republican Party to rename the Democratic Party the Socialist Democrat Party. It was the hostility of this, and also the absurdity of it, the way it occurred outside the kind of politics that our caller is talking about, where actual solutions are approached in concrete ways, was a little alarming. I think what we're beginning to see now is more figures within the Republican Party who actually do sound serious about trying to solve some of the problems we have. It's interesting, for instance, that it's Republicans who support President Obama on Afghanistan. Now, I don't know whether they're right to do that. I can't say, but it's interesting their lines are getting crossed a little bit, partly because President Obama himself is more or less continuing the policy of President George W. Bush, which is another aspect of the continuity in our politics, which is overlooked, is how little policy actually changes from president to president. We think it changes dramatically. Really what changes is the rhetoric and the language. And once we become preoccupied with that, We overlook how many deals get cut. Even Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich cut some pretty successful deals, and ending welfare or the Family Leave Act, expanding college loan opportunities for the middle class. These were policies a lot of Americans could sign on to once they got beyond the realm of rhetoric. But it's rhetoric that drives the political debate, and that's what we're hearing right now.
Well, it's interesting, even going back to the Hoover example, because if you look at some of the sort of nascent solutions that he tried to apply to the financial crisis that he was facing, they don't look so different from what ultimately was called the New Deal.
That's right. That's right. And Amity Schlaes, in her book, The Forgotten Man, essentially argues this. And she's critical of Hoover for this reason, that he himself, yes, wanted to create more of a safety net for workers. And there, see, part of his problem was a rhetorical problem. I mentioned in the book how even British Tories, you know, very right-wing conservatives in England, were shocked that Wall Street plutocrats, as they were then called, opposed unemployment insurance for those who were displaced from their jobs. They couldn't understand it. It seemed so inhumane. That was part of our attachment here in America to the idea of rugged individualism, the frontier ethos, pulling oneself up by one's bootstraps and all the rest. And one reason the New Deal alienated someone like Hoover and much of the conservative wing of the Republican Party was that it seemed to defy the great American tradition of self-betterment and self-improvement, not unlike what we're hearing today among those who angrily denounce the usurpation of the government by Harvard intellectuals, by the elite, the intelligentsia. This has been going on in America for a really long time. It's almost woven into our fabric as a people that we should have this ongoing debate. It's not really so surprising we hear it now.
Sam Tannenhaus is my guest. We're talking about his new book, The Death of Conservatism. Let's go next on the phone to Nat in Frisco. Hi, Nat.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Okay, good. Hey, I have a quick question for your guest. I'd like to know how much is recent conservatism is racially motivated? And as well, I'd like to know how come the Republican Party itself is only behind white race rather than looking, you know, notion of bringing everybody together and moving them in the right direction in that front.
We have to take a break now, but we will get Sam's response to your questions in just a moment. Sam Tannenhaus is my guest. He's editor of the New York Times Book Review and Week in Review. His new book is called The Death of Conservatism. You can be part of our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Sam Tannenhaus is my guest. He is editor of the New York Times Book Review and Week in Review. His new book is called The Death of Conservatism. And before the break, Sam, Nat was asking about whether the conservative movement as we see it in America today is in fact about race.
Well, I don't know if it is greatly about race, Chris, but the caller's question brings to light a distinction we've been talking about today, which is the difference between the Republican Party and the conservative movement. Of course, it was a Republican president, the first Republican president, Abraham Lincoln, who signed the Emancipation Proclamation. And beyond that, in the heyday of the civil rights movement, when legislation was actually passed in the 1960s, it was Northern Republicans who teamed with Northern liberals to secure passage of those bills, and also the Civil Rights Bill of 1957. And the resistance, as we know, came in part and important part from the so-called Solid South. Democrats in the Jim Crow South who had been fervent Democrats because they opposed Lincoln and the Civil War. And what the Republican Party did in the 1960s, through its first great modern tribune, Barry Goldwater, was to republicanize the Deep South. The Deep South, its representative, its electors, its legislators, flocked away from the Democratic Party in repudiation of Lyndon Johnson's civil rights agenda and moved over to the Republican Party. And the Republican Party, in turn, adopted a uniformly resistant position on issues of race. And in those ways, the parties became realigned. So we now think of the Republican Party as being a white party, which it is. There, I think J.C. Watts from Oklahoma was the last African-American representative in the Republican Party. And we also know there is not a single Republican legislator in the entire Northeast, that is, in the House of Representatives. There are, of course, the senators, Olympia Snow, Susan Collins. But the parties have become aligned with a race, with race in a way they did not for much of our modern history. And the movement itself has often identified itself with an evangelical politics or ideology also associated with the Deep South and with some of the Sun Belt. So the caller is quite right when he says the party seemed divided along these lines. It's not healthy. It's not good. It shouldn't have happened, but it did, and there we have it.
We have an email here from Joe who asks, where are the courageous voices of reason now from conservatives, if there are, in fact, any?
Great, great question, and it's the reason I wrote this book. Chris, here's what concerns me. I know I've sounded like almost like an apologist for the Republican Party when I don't think it's doing very well at all and has marginalized itself. But I'm more concerned, actually, about the intelligentsia. Here's something William F. Buckley told me. Some of your listeners may be aware that I've been writing William F. Buckley's biography for quite some years now. He wanted me to do it. He'd liked a previous book I'd written, a biography of Whitaker Chambers. And at one point I asked him, Bill Buckley, how it was he had gotten to these gifted leaders, first Barry Goldwater and then Ronald Reagan. And Buckley said, I didn't get to them. They came to me. And what he meant was they were readers of National Review, the great magazine he'd founded in 1955, that political leaders looked to intellectuals and journalists. I mean, high-caliber journalists, real men of letters, as Bill Buckley was, as James Burnham, who also figures in my book, was, as the late Irving Kristol was, Daniel Patrick Moynihan. Political figures actually gravitated towards these thinkers because from them they learned some history. They also learned a vocabulary. They learned an idiom that they could use to enlarge their political perceptions and enrich their vocabularies so that people outside the camp they were in might respond to their messages. What concerns me now is when we look at the right, we look at publications I used to write for, Commentary Magazine, National Review, The New Criterion, a literary arts journal that I wrote one of my very first essays for almost 20 years ago. When we look at those publications, or when I do, I don't see the same depth and sophistication and independence they once had. When I wrote my first article for Commentary Magazine in 1989, I think it was, the editor, Norman Podhoretz, told me, no, don't talk about parties. We're not a Republican or a Democratic publication. And I was heartened to hear that. Well, when the latest editor, Norman's son, John Podhoretz, took over a year and a half ago, he announced that the job of Commentary would be to be a voice of opposition to whoever the Democratic president was. That means they had ceased to be independent journals of opinion. If they're not independent, it means they will not attract intellectuals. So when people ask me, why are there no conservative voices, I say there are. Andrew Sullivan used to be a conservative. In fact, he still is. There's just no room for him in the movement. The great foreign policy thinker, Fareed Zakaria, you may not know it, he used to be a movement conservative. Francis Fukuyama, the social scientist who wrote the great book, The End of History, about the triumph of democracy when the Cold War ended, he used to be a movement conservative. Michael Lind, Mark Lilla, these are writers discussed in my book. They were all conservatives. They're not there anymore, not because their views have changed, but because the publications they used to write for don't have room for them. They can't allow the dissent. Another example is my colleague at the Times, David Brooks. He was a leading movement conservative as recently as 6 or 8 years ago. But now, although he is politely viewed by the right, he has almost nothing in common anymore because he is not within the fellowship. He's not inside the cloister. And that's why we're not hearing the voices, the ideas, the articulation of that crosses the bridge from philosophy to policy that your listener is asking about.
So what keeps this group of intellectuals who have been sort of pushed out of the mainstream conservative publications and can't express their views there from coming together in one place and forming something that is fresher and still true to traditional conservative ideals?
Well, I think what happened, Chris, is that very attractive liberal publications welcomed them in, and they became nice places to settle. Look at me. I'm at the New York Times. I was writing essays for the New York Review of Books. For 5 years, I was a contributing editor to Vanity Fair. These are nice places to write for, particularly if the editors are hospitable. So I think what happens is when you look at the others I've mentioned is they write their books, they teach, or they if you're David Brooks, you write a column. If you're Andrew Sullivan, you write this brilliantly successful blog. They have become, I think, alienated from the very idea of ideology, which in itself, by the way, is a conservative notion. Conservatism was originated with Edmund Burke as a repudiation of all ideology. So in a sense, they're being true to themselves as conservatives by not banding together. I think they've seen that, they've done it, and they've decided it doesn't work, that the best place for them is to be in the middle of society, in the middle of the culture where their work can be read, and they can just participate in a broader conversation. In that sense, conservatism is dead.
Let's speak next to Tim in Dallas. Hello, Tim.
Hey, great program as always. My thoughts on it are, in listening to the program, is I totally get it in terms of the possibility of what you call the death of conservatism, particularly when you kind of look at the idea of the fringes versus, you know, the more, I guess you could call moderate conservatives that you see out there. But as someone who is a member of the Democratic Party and is fairly liberal, I actually see a complete parallel happening on our side of the fence. And the main reason that is because, you know, I always believed that the Democratic Party was the party of thinkers, and the conservatives and the Republicans were the party of believers. And where that often came to light for me, and often was a source of pride, was because the Republicans and the conservatives, as has been mentioned before, they get in lockstep very quickly, and they're all about one message, and they just pound it and pound it and pound it and pound it, and they don't really debate within themselves, at least openly. Whereas, you know, the Democratic Party has always been one, and particularly in I would say the last, you know, half a century or so, have always been somewhat divided within themselves because they take the time seemingly to debate within themselves. And what I'm seeing happen for me right now is particularly with the Obama administration and the agenda that they have, is that ultimately this debate that happens within, that I'm ultimately proud of, I'm afraid, is also going to be the death of the agendas, and ultimately could also become another fracture off just the fringes and the regular conservatives that we've grown to know. So I think that there's definitely a parallel, and obviously another opportunity for a book for our guest. And I'd love to hear his comments.
Tim, thanks for your call. What do you think, Sam?
You know, it's a great point. I spoke to a conservative group in Washington, the American Enterprise Institute, a week or so ago. And someone said, well, couldn't you have written a book called The Death of Liberalism? And I said, I could, only it wouldn't be as interesting, because conservatives really have dominated so much of our politics for the last generation or two. But it's true that, in a way, this fracturing and fragmentation is what on both sides is really what we want. I mean, I know that sounds perverse because there are so many great problems we need to solve. But we forget at our peril, I think, how much of politics is about conversation, negotiating differences, acknowledging differences, and then still finding some way to piece together the best kind of policy we can. One of the conservatives I really admire, Gary Wills, who began as a movement conservative and also drifted away many years ago, said that we tend to be seduced by the idea in politics of accomplishing the big thing. Ronald Reagan had that. Barack Obama has that. Well, he wants to make some massive change or solve some huge problem, when instead maybe we're almost better off doing the Clinton thing, the incremental change that enough people can accept, whoever they are, that it doesn't feel dramatic at all. So in a sense, this kind of fragmenting of politics, the debates that occur within the parties, the watering down of bills and legislation, may have the effect of preparing us all for them. So the world doesn't seem to be changing as much. I think one reason we're seeing this vehement protest against Barack Obama is because of a generational group we tend to overlook in our politics, although they were first revealed to us when the previous president, George W. Bush, tried to do something parallel to what President Obama's doing now and add private accounts to Social Security. Remember that, the privatization of Social Security? It was the same constituency who rebelled. It was the increasing contingent population of the elderly. For those people now, America seems a very different place. You know, here's a little mind game you can play. Someone who is 70 years old now, well into our Social Security and Medicare system, was born in 1939. He or she was 15 when the Supreme Court passed its landmark legislation in the Brown case, the Brown decision, was 20 years old when Hawaii actually became a state. No wonder the idea of Obama's Hawaiian upbringing is confusing to some. Was 22 years old when a new president, John F. Kennedy, said, "We are locked in a twilight struggle with the forces of evil, the Soviet Union." No wonder the words socialism and communism are back in play. In other words, there has been a transformation in our politics, and it's a particular segment of the population. The one demographic group, by the way, that voted strongly Republican in this last election, those who were old enough to qualify for Social Security and Medicare, who historically were Democrats, somehow became Republicans, probably out of the fear of the unknown. These fragmentations occur over and over in our politics, and in a way, we should welcome them. It's the noise of democracy that's actually kind of a virtuous noise. It really can become the music of our disharmonies that in some way converge into something better. So the caller is absolutely right about these parallel dissolutions left and right. It's why I have a chapter in the book on the failure of the Great Society. And I think it's part of what we will be looking at in the next generation. I think he's absolutely right.
Sam Tannenhaus is editor of both the New York Times Book Review and Week in Review. His new book is called The Death of Conservatism. Sam, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, Chris, it was great. You were very patient. Nice talking with you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.